Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Commander Clash podcast, where the Commander Clash crew talks all things Commander. And this week, we are talking about cards that people wanted to get banned or thought were super busted during spoiler season, and maybe it didn't quite turn out that way for all these cards. So basically, cards that everyone super overrated. But before we get to the cards, we got a crew to introduce, and we have a special guest this week in Morgan. Welcome back, Morgan. Krim couldn't be here. He's out a little bit sick today. So good to see you, Morgan.
Good to see you guys. Happy to be here to talk about Not Sol Ring.
Yeah. I'm always down for talking about Not Sol Ring. We also have Budget Commander Tomer. How's it going today, Tomer?
I'm doing well. I know I was a hater on a lot of these, so justified. But there's actually one I'm very excited to talk about because I'm like, yo, it's actually as hyped as it's supposed to be.
I'm excited to see what that one is. We'll get to it soon. But we also have Brewer's Kitchen. Phil, what's up, Phil? How's it going today?
Hey, all. Super funny topic. Like every spoiler season, there's something people lose their mind about, and then there's some random card everybody overlooked that is the actual good card. Yeah.
Yep, that is usually how it goes. And I mean, I've lost my mind. I'm Seth, probably better known as Saffron Olive, and I've definitely lost my mind about a few of these cards, only to find out later they were not exactly as good as I was hoping, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, we got a couple of sponsors today. Our show is brought to you by Foil Armor. Do you have problems with your foils curling? Well, Foil Armor is the ultimate solution to flattening your foils. It's a two-way humidity pack that you simply put inside an airtight container with your cards, and Foil Armor will absorb and release moisture, making your cards completely flat. Put a pack in a storage box to keep your cards flat forever, and you can head over to foilarmor.com and use the code MTGGoldfish to get 15% off. And our show is also brought to you by Card Conduit, the easiest way to sell your Magic cards. If you ever get tired of the hassles of buy listing, you can skip them with Card Conduit. You can use your curated service where you send in as many cards as you want with a buy list value of a dollar or more and pay just a 5% service fee. And if you want to do a bit of work, you can use a sorted service where you list and sort your cards in advance and pay just a 2% fee. Either way, you're going to get a detailed report with the results in a fast payment once your order is processed. And you can even get another 10% off by heading over to cardconduit.com/MTGGoldfish. Card Conduit, it's the easiest way to sell your Magic cards. So thank you to our sponsors for supporting the show. And now it's time for the comment of the week. So last week, we talked about cards that we overestimated, and our top comment comes from Tormsgarn, who says, I'll vote for a Phyrexian Arena and similar podcast. One of the things we pitched was maybe we got to do a Phyrexian Arena tier list, and it seems like the comments agree, so maybe we got to add it to the list.
Definitely enough to make it worth it, yeah.
Plus, I want you to know, Seth, I'm back on the Phyrexian Arena train. Plus, I built a pre-modern Shaner deck.
Good if you're playing pre-modern. Oh, yes. Palmer, so close. So
I made the cut.
You're getting there. I mean, plus we just got a really good, maybe new Phyrexian Arena in the Spider-Man set. That like white thing where you got to like tap a couple treasures or creatures and you draw a card each turn. So maybe that's a reason to actually do the tier list. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's talk about cards that people want to get banned during spoiler season. And boy, are there some good ones in here. And let's start with, I think, one of the first cards I think of when this topic comes up. And that card is Bootlegger's Stash. So Bootlegger's Stash, it's a 6-mana artifact. It's green. And it says lands you control have trap to make a treasure token. And I will say, when this card was first spoiled, I thought it looked super busted, right? I knew it was green, which is a little awkward because does green need like treasure ramp because it's so good at land ramping? But I was like, I mean, this card's got to be great. You play it, you just like store up all this mana, think all the treasures you can make. Green's the color of token doubler, so you got a doubling season and you make double the treasures. That's going to be awesome. And then even when I play treasure decks, they're either not in green or I don't play this card because it's just so slow. But I'm curious, what happened with Bootlegger's Stash? How'd we get it so wrong, guys?
They printed Open the Way.
Open the Way. Yeah, I guess for 6-mana, Open the Way just wins you the game. And Bootlegger's Stash is like, next turn you get to make some treasures.
Well, it's like the definition of like, just like a big, flashy, do-nothing card. Mm-hmm. Like, this makes doubling season look good. I'm sorry. Because like, Bootlegger's Stash is the same thing, where it's like, you spent 6 mana, you're probably not going to get value out of it the turn you cast it, because you're probably tapping your lance to make those treasures that turn. You have to wait an entire turn cycle for it to do anything. And then what are you doing with it, really? Like, you have to have, it's very like specific where you can be good with it. Like, Ginny Fae, for example, can turn those treasures into like dogs and cats, and that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But even like, that's the best case scenario, it's not going to be that yeah, I wild. Guess the
best case scenario is Corvold, but it is interesting how it does. Even if you untap with it, it just does technically nothing by itself. Unless you play Corvold or whatever, you're playing Corvold.
Yeah, the couple of decks that I've seen it played in that I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty good, is decks with like Seedborn Muse or something where you can like untap your lands and make even more treasures. That's pretty insane. Decks that maybe have no or next to no non-permanents in the deck. I have a deck that's built off of those, like, shuffle all the cards in your library deck and get that many permanents. So I have a deck that's built around that. So, like, I have this in there just because I want as much of my ramp as possible to be, you know, not instants and sorcery, so I have more targets to hit off of that. But for the most part, yeah, it's a 6-mana do-nothing that also draws a lot of hate because people thought it was going to be busted.
It's also like Capenna was the height of people being fed up with treasure. Because like Watsi has like this tendency of like they'll come up with a good mechanic, like a cool mechanic. Treasures were really, really cool and innovative at the time. And then they'll be like, okay, what if we just did that mechanic for the next like 2 years?
And
we'll do
other
it more
card.
And more and more. Yeah. Because it's like, it's good. Let's just keep doing it. So they just like did treasure. And then in Yucapeta was just like, we're the treasure set. And people were like so tired of it. And they said it's so power crept. And then they see this and they're like, green gets this? One of the best treasure makers ever? Ugh. And everybody was like losing their minds over this card. So I feel like it was like also the context of the time was also like feeding into this narrative.
Threat for this today, just to see what people said about these cards. And there were a lot of comments saying like they put treasures on everything, and then it is to be fair a pretty efficient way to make treasures if you get value from making or cracking treasures. Actually, the next cards not the next, but the second to next. There are cards that profit from treasures.
There are cards that synergize with it. Like, what card that Phil is hinting at here and is also coming up on our list, so we might as well talk about it now. And this one kind of blew my mind, because I remember being on Twitter during spoiler season when the tweets started coming around with people saying, this card should be banned. And I just, my brain could not comprehend what people were talking about. And that card is a lowly common named Mirkwood Bats, a 4-mana 2/3 flying bat that when you create or sacrifice a token, each opponent loses a life. And I am still not convinced, in defense of Mirkwood Bats, I am still not convinced that there wasn't some account that was like had 10 followers and was brand new to Magic and like somehow posted this tweet and then it just like took off and everyone was talking about it and became a thing. Because I'm still not sure I ever saw anyone who I knew was like a longtime Magic player that thought Mirkwood Bats needed to be banned, but that was a huge conversation around the card. And it is very good, right, Phil, if you have some treasure production, because you're making and sacking treasures, so.
It's very good.
It's a wincon in my Necrobloom deck,
yep,
and it kills people, but it's also 4 mana, and it's
it requires a board, too.
Fair.
I think, To its credit, I feel like this was also, you know, during the height of treasures and stuff. I remember this was also like the height of like Prosper's popularity too. Like Prosper came out like 2 years before that. It was like the most played Rakdos commander. And that poops out a lot of treasure. So this could be a very good finisher for those style of decks. So I can kind of see like the context of the time. People are fed up with treasures. They're fed up with like token makers. It's too easy, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like yet another finisher. It requires a board, like a significant board state to do significant amounts of damage. It's not like you could just plop this out and immediately GG your opponents or anything.
And Commander's a format where people pop up with Blood Artist, which costs 2 mana. And when you sack a creature, you get to deal a damage. And there's even tons of infinite loops for it. So that's the part for me. It was just like, compared to the other similar cards in the format, how is Mirkwood Bats across the line? Although I will say, this card did end up being good. If you look on EDH Rec, like Bootlegger Stash is in like 2% of decks or something. Mirkwood Bats actually in 9, almost 10% of decks, and is kind of like, I wouldn't say a staple, but it's an archetype staple. Like if you're making a lot of tokens and stuff, you're probably going to play it in your deck. So I don't think it completely flopped, but I also don't think Morgan it need to be banned, right? It hasn't been like a problematic card.
No, when that was going viral, I was like, am I the one that's out of touch? What am eye missing. And it is a very good card. Like, one of my favorite decks right now is the Taysa from Murders at Karlov Manor. It's one of my favorite commander decks right now. And this is one of the best cards in there because it's one of your finishers, but it doesn't make tokens by itself. It's four mana, so it sits in your hand for a while. It doesn't sacrifice the tokens by itself. So it is very, very good, but it's not banworthy by any stretch of the imagination. So that was just kind of a weird blip of everyone being tired of all the token shenanigans, I think.
Yeah. It's also in my Taysa, the same one. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, we have a classic. I remember this one. Elishnorn, Mother of Machines. And this card caused quite the kerfuffle as soon as it was spoiled, actually. So if you don't know Elishnorn, it's a 5-mana legendary 4/7 Phyrexian Praetor with vigilance. And it essentially Panharmonicons for you. If something entering the battlefield triggers something, you do it twice. And it stops anything from entering the battlefield of any of your opponent's stuff. Your opponent's permanents won't trigger when they enter the battlefield. And this was a card that was very interesting because I love my Panharmonicon. So when I saw this, my eyes lit up because I was like, oh, this is like the most playable Panharmonicon that they've printed. Yeah, it even hates on my opponent's stuff. But then I saw a lot of people were really concerned about the Staxi aspect, right? Like, this is a card that people like me are going to put in their decks to be a Panharmonicon. Mm-hmm. But then it accidentally kind of like hoses your opponents really hard. And I've played quite a few games against Elishnorn since. And it still does kind of do that. There are certainly games that I've played where someone plays an Elishnorn, and I'm just like, all right, I guess my deck like just doesn't work this pod. Like, it's just not going to do anything until it leaves the battlefield. But I also have heard people complaining about banning it. So what do you guys think happened with Elishnorn?
I hate it.
it really is.
Like, I don't want to ban it, but Jesus Christ.
Well, because so much of
your... Play in my Lorna's deck.
Yeah. Well, so many people are like willing to like pay one or two extra mana to get an effect stapled onto a creature, right? Like, why would I play Murder when I could play Ravenous Chupacabra and now I have a attacking and blocking body? And like, that is like a deck building philosophy that a lot of people just have. And now you're just like, okay, 80% of your deck does nothing now. And that's kind of brutal.
Well,
more than 80 for my Lorna's deck.
But Ravenous is also like, so you can blink it and stuff. Yep. This one, I feel like it's actually being a creature is a liability here because it does have the stacks aspect to it. So people want to get it removed. It doesn't have any built-in resiliency. Like,
but it turns off my Ravenous Chupacabra, so I can't talk
to it. I know. Yeah. I know.
My Yara
like,
deck.
Yeah, I can understand the reasoning why some people would not like this card because it's like, people are just want to run it for the Panharmonicon for you, and it just so happens that it also stacks as
it's kind of stacks, bro.
Fine, sure, it's stacks.
It's kind of stacks.
Anything that slows down my game plan is stacks too. My Murder is stacks too. My commander, whatever. It slows down Panharmonicon decks. I still think this is so fine. Like, I mean, if your entire blink deck doesn't have like a single board wipe, a single Swords to Plowshares or something, I don't know. Maybe this will
a single
will push
that's
you.
One in 99 cards though. Like, you mean yeah, like five or something
tutors?
To realistically
I will. You have some tutors? Do you have like any redundancy? No.
As a Panharmonicon player, I will say, Tomer, like, I think, like, yes, you're right. You should be able to answer it in some way. But if you're building like a Yarok Panharmonicon style deck, you're also kind of incentivized to play Ravenous Chupacabra over a Assassin's Trophy or something. Because you're like, oh, it synergizes with my commander. And I want as many cards as possible that synergize because I don't just want to play all the good stuff. I want my deck to be thematic. So then if you actually go all in on being like thematic and making everything work with the plan, then you actually do get straight up hosed. If you don't do that and you're like, oh, I'm going to play a bunch of One Rings and Swords to Plowshares in my deck, then yeah, whatever, no problem. But I think that's kind of like the tension of it, right? Like, but isn't that the tension of like staying committed to the flavor versus like playing good cards to get yourself out of the situations that you could run into?
The other, go ahead.
Oh, I think there's like level up moments with brewing. There's one where like you want to be super thematic. You want every single card to fit the theme, and I think that's like I think that's like how I always approach brewing too, especially like if you're on a budget.
Yeah.
You can't run staples, right? Like you can't put the One Ring if you have a $50 budget because the One Ring's already over your budget. So you have to find thematic options to everything. But at the same time, I don't know, once you play the deck a couple times, you're going to realize that there's certain cards that are just like unbeatable for you. Like I still remember the one time I built a mono red Super Friends deck. I brought it onto Commander Clash, which was a Chandra deck, and somebody dropped down the Immortal Sun. And I was like, I have red planeswalkers to deal with your thing. But like I had a single answer in the entire deck for the Immortal Sun that wasn't a planeswalker, and it was a Chaos Warp, and it was already in my graveyard. And then I was like, you know what I should do? I added a couple more removal spells to just deal with it, because it's like, I don't want to lose to just having one card just sit there, you know? It's like, so I think that's like the tuning process for decks is like, yes, you should go heavy on your theme, but then also if you just lose to cards that are fairly popular, you should try and address that.
Yeah. Well, the other awkward thing about the card is that even if your ETBs are turned off and you just have the bodies, well, you could be like, oh, well, I'll just attack the Elesh Norn player and eventually they'll have to block and kill it. But it's a 4-7.
It's a 4-7.
Okay?
The biggest bug.
And Muldrifter flies. It doesn't have reach. It's a 2-2.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, Phil, before we move on to the next card. So this all happened in the pre-bracket era. Do you think, if we were living in the current era when Elesh Norn was spoiled, do you think the reaction would be different? Do you think people would still be like, you shouldn't have printed it, it should be banned? Or do you think people would just be like, oh, it's bracket 4 or whatever, it's going to be, you know, whatever, I won't face it anyway? Like, how much do you think the bracket system plays into this, if at all?
I thought that the bracket system would kind of introduce this philosophy. I haven't seen it yet, but I would have actually imagined them to say everything's unbanned and bracket whatever.
Yeah.
But so far, I haven't seen people. So I think people learn from this kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. Do you remember A Realm Reborn? The 6-mana enchantment from Final Fantasy? Everything, like every permanent you have taps for any color. I think if this released at Bootlegger Stash's times, this would have had the same reaction, but people kind of learned.
Ooh.
So maybe nowadays people won't
react
because they know. But Elesh Norn
is
kind of egregious still. I don't want anything banned, but
the card's kind of
bad.
This one is
pretty brutal. It's no Mirkwood bans.
Ooh, all right, let's move on to another white card. And this one, I don't think anyone thinks, is too brutal. And that card is Monologue Tax. Monologue Tax. It's a 3-mana white enchantment. This was that says whenever opponent casts their second spell each turn, you create a treasure token. And this came out in what set, Tomer? Do you remember what Commander precon this was? I'm trying to remember.
2021. The Strixhaven Commander decks.
Yeah.
So I remember people being super hyped for this card. Was this card ever good?
I think
good?
It's Streets. It's New Capenna.
Is it Streets and New Capenna?
Is it New Capenna?
So it's still, everything's from New Capenna. If we don't know it, it's just always from Streets and New Capenna Commander. Yeah. Sure. But it was a while ago now. Is this a case that the card always just sucked and people wanted it banned for no reason? Or they printed a lot of like good white treasure makers and card draw effects since then? Has this just been power crap by cards that have come after it? Like what happened with Monologue Tax? Why is this card so bad?
This card has never been good. I think people like, so context wise, at the beginning of like 2020 area. Well, I think a Smothering Tide was 2019. I think it was like War of the Spark Guilds of Ravnica or something
Guilds,
like that.
Yeah.
Monologue Tax, there was like, so right at the beginning of 2020, like 2019, 2018, Commander was really growing in popularity. And during that growth, a lot of the community kind of like was complaining about Mono White, being like, white kind of sucks. And it was kind of like even a meme. Like there were just like memes in the community that white is just like bad at card draw and bad at ramp. And I don't think they were ever bad at ramp, even in 2019. But card draw, definitely. You had to like jump through some ridiculous hoops to draw cards. But like the idea was like the two best things in Commander and multiplayer is card draw and ramp. Like that's just known. It's been known forever. And if a color is historically bad at doing those two things, it's going to be a weak color. So everybody was memeing on white being awful. And slowly, Watsi was hearing the feedback, and they're like, okay, we'll introduce some things to, you know, kind of fix that a little bit, but without breaking the color pie. And Monologue Tax was one of the early attempts at addressing the issue. This was like Cartographer's Talk around the same time, too.
The classic. Yeah.
And I mean, like, they undershot a little bit with this one. A lot of people were very excited, though, you know, because they're like, oh, my God.
White's making
Anna. White's ramping.
Oh, my God.
White's ramping so much. That's insane.
And
but yeah, it was not.
And this was also,
I gotta say, I mixed it up. It is from Strixhaven.
I thought you were joking.
It with Smuggler's Share, which is pretty similar, and might talk about this as well.
That one's the truth.
Yeah, I think Monologue Tax, it still reads better than it plays. Whenever we play it, it's like, oh, did it trigger once? Like, I think it has to trigger 3 times to be, I guess then it's just neutral, although it would feel like worth it.
Yeah, it's just not something that triggers as much as like Smothering Tithe. Or like Smothering Tithe, like everyone's drawing cards because it's Commander. And in Monologue Tax, not all decks care if you're double spelling. You can just like curve out, and a lot of decks are just fine. Or, I mean, it's not even a strong enough effect that you try to play around it, but a lot of decks can play at instant speed as well. So I don't think it triggers often enough to be worth it.
I think
can
people
only inherently trigger only once each turn because it's the second spell. So if one player goes off, it just triggers once.
Yeah, I guess if two opponents somehow cast spells in one person's turn, it could trigger, but that's very unlikely. Do you think part of this is just like Smothering Tithe was so good and it came out just a year or two before this card? And this was also when treasures were like a big conversation about treasures being OP going back to that era. Do you think people just wanted another Smothering Tithe, and this was the card was like, oh my God, it's going to be the second coming of Smothering Tithe, and everyone overrated it because of that comparison? Do you think that was maybe part of it?
I think so. Also, I think double spelling isn't, like, it will be happening. Like, I think, like, in an average turn cycle, you should be able to get one treasure, hopefully two. But even if you're getting, like, let's say two treasures every single turn cycle of this, is that worth it for a 3-drop? Maybe in 2015, yes. But, like, I don't know. Just, like, drop down a Worn Power Stone at that point, and then you're fine. You know, like, it needs to do more. And then Watsi, like, took that feedback, and they're like, I got you. Trouble in pairs. Yeah. And that's where we're at now. So careful which cards you slam on podcasts and stuff, I guess, is the moral of the story in there.
Since we're talking about white cards and trying to fix white's card draw and ramping, let's move to another more recent card, another 3-mana white enchantment, Smuggler's Share. So this one, 3-mana white enchantment, at the beginning of each end step, you draw a card for each opponent who drew 2 or more cards this turn, then you create a treasure for each opponent who had 2 or more lands enter the battlefield under their control each turn. And this was another card, I think this was Murders at Karlov Manor Commander, so
this one is from New Capenna.
This one
is. This one actually is
from New Capenna, yes.
So this one looks a lot similar to the last card we were talking about, right? It's a 3-mana enchantment that's going to make treasures based on what your opponent's does. This is a card I've seen on the battlefield a few times, and it just does not trigger as much as you think it would.
Lies!
Do you like this one, Tomer? Yeah. Do you like this one? It turns out that it's just like, it triggers the beginning of each end step, but to draw with it, you need opponents to draw at least 2 cards in the turn, and to make a treasure, you need 2 lands to enter, which is just a lot going on. It's a big ask to have that happening consistently. Do you think it's actually good, Tomer? Is this one still good?
Yes.
Do you play it? Really?
Yes,
give me your pitch.
When it was released, okay, we've been doing this for a long time. When it was released, we talked about cards that we were like, excited for New Capenna. And this is one of the ones I was like, this card is very, very good. And y'all poo-pooed me at the time. I remember this. I hold grudges, as you know.
I do know.
And then I remember there was like, we did one season where I was like jamming this in every single white deck possible. And I remember they're like, you all were like, oh, it doesn't do anything. And there was like one commenter, I forget your name, I'm so sorry, the username. But like for the entire season, they're like, If you played a smuggler's share on like turn three here, you would have drawn XYZ number of cards for blah, 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 blah. Like he kept the tally for every single video, every single episode. There was a comment. You could go back. I forget which season it was, but it's still there, I'm pretty sure. And it was like, yeah, this is a banger card. It's good. It scales up though. Like if you are in a meta where people are actually playing fetch lands, this card is actually good. This card is actually good and very consistent. I think it scales down, though. If you're like in bracket two, if you're at a lower power table, that no fetches and stuff, then it starts not being worth it. But if you're in like bracket three, if you're at like a Commander Clash meta, I think this card is absolutely the truth. Just you got to have fetch lands around, I think. And you guys love drawing cards.
I do love drawing cards. That is true. Yeah. I mean, maybe it would be good in the Clash meta. We never see it, though. What do you think, Morgan and Phil?
I think it probably draws enough cards that it's worth considering just because everyone else is going to be drawing cards. So that part probably triggers. But I agree with Tomer that the treasure part is kind of only worth it if you know your regular play group has a lot of fetch lands. Like my normal play group that I used to do my YouTube show with, we have a lot of one and two color decks in our play group. And so we just don't see as many fetch lands. And this wouldn't be very good there. So I think that's really what it comes down to. But I think it draws an okay amount of cards at an average table that, like, if you just want it as a card draw slot, it's probably worth considering. But also, card draw has gotten so insane in Commander recently that I don't know if you need it anymore for that either. But makes a decent amount of treasures if you've got fetches.
I think it's a little bit power crap.
I mean, we've seen it relatively.
It was on a game kind of recently.
I can remember. Seen it relatively recently, yeah. And I think it triggered a couple of times. It's just not what people were hoping for at spoiler season. Like, monologue text and this, I mean, obviously the ceiling is crazy. That's why people thought they would be very good.
People underestimate this card, and now we got trouble in Paris, so that's where we're at. This is the next step. It was really the next step. After Smuggler Share, people were like, okay, you don't like this? Then let's ramp it up a little bit more. That's literally what they did.
I don't know. I think the fetch land thing, but not every form of card advantage is card draw. We've seen it. Like, Risen Reef effects or something don't count as card draw or impulse draw. And then oftentimes you just play 4 mana, play Fairy Artisan, insane value, but not triggering anything here. And then maybe play an Urza or I guess a ring. Yeah, this triggers this very consistently. But
well, also green land ramp. Just like if you're up against green decks, this is going to trigger pretty consistently.
At least in like the early game or whatever it
once
should.
For one
but
player
I guess that's only
early
once
game.
Per turn cycle. Interesting. I don't know. Maybe I got to reevaluate it. I just sort of wrote this card
I'll
off
jam
because
more.
I decided that it was bad. So I never tried anymore. But maybe it's worth trying. But let's move on to another one. And I know what went wrong with this one. This card is Spiteful Banditry. It's double red and X. And when it enters, it deals X damage to each creature. And whenever one or more creatures your opponent's control dies, you create a treasure token only once each turn. So this came out in the Lord of the Rings set. And this card I was pretty high on. When I saw this, I was like, ooh, this is the Red Meat Hook Massacre. It's kind of the same thing, right? It's an enchantment with an X effect. It came out, I think, like a few months after, or like within a year
of
Meat Hook Massacre. And as soon as I saw this, I was like, oh, this is just Red Meat Hook. I'm going to make treasures. It's going to be great. I'll play it in every deck. And I still think this card is fine. And I still do play it in like devotion decks or decks that really care about treasures that are in red, but it is definitely not the Meat Hook Massacre. It doesn't kill your opponents. It doesn't buffer your life total. But I think that's what went wrong with this one is everyone, including myself, just jumped to the Meat Hook comparison when they saw the enchantment wrath with the X mana symbols, and it just wasn't as good as that one. But what do you guys think about Spiteful Banditry?
I'd still overvalue it. I can't believe it's not as good as I think.
It seems like it should be good, doesn't it?
It seems so good.
I got bamboozled too. It was preview season. I'm like, I'm all in, baby. This card is the truth. I won't be able to ever afford it because it's a mythic. It'll be like $500. so I didn't really get to play with it that much. But then, I think like Meat Hook Massacre, it's like, it's not, I think the board wipe on both of those is kind of not that great. Like it costs a lot of mana and I don't like that. But Meat Hook you're in black, so devotion is more important because you run like Gary often. These decks often end with a Gary loop or whatever. And it's a legit win condition, right? Like if you are in black, one of the most popular archetypes is aristocrats. If you're sacrificing stuff, you're using that to win the game off that, just with the meat hook on the battlefield. Whereas the banditry, what can you do? This is not, you can't combo. You got one treasure per turn. It's capped. So, like, its ceiling potential is very much lower, and you're not in the colors to really utilize it.
Although, I think that if you're just talking, obviously this doesn't draw cards, but if you're just talking about treasure production, I think it's better than Smuggler's Share. I mean, we saw this on Commander Clash recently, and I thought it did insane, because, you know, I don't know if there's going to be fetch lands at the table. I don't know if there's going to be green players at a table, but I do know there's going to be creatures, and I know they're going to die. So I think if you just care about making some incidental treasures here and there, running this out where X equals zero is actually still going to be a decent ramp spell in a lot of red decks.
I feel like Tomer did that recently in the Clive.
He did do that.
I think it was the turn two, so, just run it out. And I think you made a couple treasures, right?
Yeah.
It was literally, but it's literally a Clive deck. Like, yeah. Clive in the command zone, if I put Spiteful Banditry there, it literally draws me two cards whenever Clive enters. So I put it in there, but I don't know. I feel like I'm going to have to run Smuggler's Share so much more. Like, obviously, it's not as good as Trouble in Paris. I think, the main thing that kind of killed it. But, like, since we don't run Trouble in Paris, thank God, anymore, I'm going to bring it back, you know?
Well, let's move on.
I want to run Spiteful Banditry more.
I'm convinced it's good.
I think it's still fine. I think it's I don't know about good, but I think it's still fine. But let's keep moving on. I got another good one. And this card, oh man, I was so high on this card. I just recently removed it from my last deck, and I had in so many decks at first. Lithiform Engine. So Lithiform Engine, it's a 4-mana legendary artifact. You can pay 2 and tap it to copy an activated or triggered ability you control and choose new targets for the copy. You can pay 3 and tap it to copy an instant or sorcery spell you control, and you can choose new targets for the copy. You can pay 4 and tap a copy a permanent spell you control, and the copy becomes a token. So when this came out, that was a very new ability, right? To make a copy of a permanent and it becomes a token was something that Wizards was just kind of starting to put into Magic. And when I saw this card, it looked like the ultimate Painharmonic on it. Could copy anything. Not only do I double my ETB triggers, I even get another copy of the creature itself. So I jammed this in so many decks. I thought this was going to be like such a staple. And over the last like few years, I have just come to realize the card is just way too slow. Like, it's 4 to cast. If you want to copy a permanent, you need 4 more mana. Like, how am I going to cast a cool permanent and have 4 mana left over to copy it? Just like in practice, it doesn't work out that way. Plus, they've printed a lot more of like make a copy of things. We got like Shiko and we got Flame Hold Grappler and like make a copy of a permanence becoming more and more common. So this card just isn't as unique and exciting as it was. So I think that's what went wrong. It was just too slow, but what went wrong with Lithiform Engine? And were you guys high on this too, or was I the only one who was like so high on this card?
This is our preview card, by the way.
Yeah.
So the reason why it's on this list is people were calling it banned. People were saying, like, you're just blatant power creeping at this point. You literally took Strionic Resonator and Rings of Brighthoof and you threw it together. And now you have something else on top of it. What's going on? Wizards of the Coast. I was down on this. Obviously, I had to be polite when we were previewing this card because I'm not going to say it's garbage. Thanks, Watsy, for nothing. But I've always felt like this card is just like, it promises a lot. It gets your eyes wide open. Everybody's excited, which is like most of these cards, honestly, like Bootlegger Stash and whatever. But it's just so slow. It's so freaking slow. It costs too much mana. And it's just like, as Commander gets faster and faster, you're looking for more mana efficiency. Card draw just kind of gets thrown to you for free. So at this point, like, you might as well find better uses of your mana. You're not trying to be mana efficient with, like, generate card advantage from the same card over and over again by sinking mana into it. You just want to, like, dump your hand of these, like, super powerful, super pushed cards. And this thing is just, like, it's just too much mana. Yeah. Like, why? You have 8 other cards in your hand to cast. I don't know.
If this came out in 2016 or something, this would be a different story. Like, I would have jammed this in so many decks because the format just wasn't as fast. But yeah, it is just a little too clunky. It reads really sweet and really cool. And like, hey, this is the kind of card that ideally, this is what the Commander format is for, you know, is we get right. to play these big, splashy, awesome, exciting cards. But unfortunately, the format has just been power crept, and now we can't even play those cards anymore, hardly ever. So it's a card I try to remember every now and then. And I have run it in one or two decks before, but yeah, unfortunately, it's just too slow.
I still run it in Mishra because his triggered ability is, it's good enough to copy it for 6 mana. I remember people saying, oh, this goes in every deck. And I think that's like a trap that artifacts just fall into.
Mm. Being colorless, because there's,
yeah, maybe that's still the problem of the ghost of Mono White being bad. As when an artifact does anything, it's like,
right?
Oh my God, like, this gives white copies now
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I still run it in a dedicated artifact deck that makes artifacts cheaper, has a very strong ability to copy. I think this card would be insanely fun if it could copy any, not just your own instant sorceries and creatures.
That would be awesome.
Then, oh my
sure.
God.
I
you can
bet that
use fetches and stuff.
Mm. Give it a couple
yeah.
years, Phil. Give it a
yeah,
couple
power
years.
So good. And it'll cost
it
like
would
half
still be
as much mana for everything,
slow.
Too.
I think yeah. if it was just like 2 mana to cast or something, it would be way better. Just like needing 4 to get it
yes.
going and then needing so much mana to go into it yeah. is just, it's such a big ask.
Once
so.
It's on the board, it's crazy. Like, even with worry. Fetches and stuff, you
that
find something
you
to
get
do
value
with
out of it.
Everything. Having to pay 4 is very steep, and you don't really play it on 4.
They'll
so,
just
yeah,
remove
well,
the mana
cost. This
would
cost
that'll
2.
Be fine.
Yeah. If it was a free spell, it might be okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're like an artifact reanimator deck or something, then it gets a lot better.
Yeah.
If you have
yeah.
other things worth
especially
copying.
If you reanimate with an ability.
Let's move on to a very different card. Definitely not a colorless card or a 4-mana card. We have a card that, as I'm reading it now, I'm like, why did anyone actually think this card would even be good in Commander? And that is the Crim Special, Lord Xander the Collector. Lord Xander is a 7-mana 6/6 Vampire Demon Noble that when it enters, target opponent discards half the cards in their hand rounded down. When it attacks, defending player mills half their library rounded down. And when Xander dies, target opponent sacks half their non-land permanents rounded down. So Xander reads like it does a ton. Like, it's just got this huge wall of text. You're like, wow, I get their hand, I get their library, I get their permanent, I'm getting everything. But it's 7 mana. It has to die or attack to do most of those abilities, and it only hits one opponent, which I think is the biggest deal breaker with this card, is like, you're not even like getting everyone. You're just like, Krim played this recently on a Commander Clash, and it just looks so incredibly tame. Like, you still kind of hope. I think he played it for 7 mana, mm-hmm. and one player discarded like 2 cards or something, and I was like, that's your Commander? 7 mana enters, someone discards 2? That just does not seem anywhere near good enough. But what am I missing? Because this card was super hype. People were so scared. Is it just that people read this as something that's going to disrupt their game plan and they're like, oh my God, I don't want to be the person who's getting hit by this, so don't print it.
Well, it's a scary card. Like, you don't want to, if you got, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think people were mad that you can put the Friendship Destroyer in the command zone there,
mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, there's Turgrid and stuff, so it was never worrying, but I remember that when the set came out, Krim played it, and I think he did us a little dirty with it.
I kind of remember
if you build
that.
Around it as a commander, you can play it, attack, sacrifice it, and then really half wreck people. It kind of sucks that it's always just half,
people.
So it kind of only messes with
and what's funny is I think part of why we think like now it's like, well, this card actually isn't very good is the same reason that people were scared of it and hating on it, is that it only targets one person with it. If it hit everyone would just be like, all right, that's a little bit of a boogeyman, we need to watch out for that.
Yeah.
But because you're targeting one person, yeah, it makes it a lot worse, but it's so rude.
It feels bad.
It's like the Annihilator problem, right? That just one person's getting wrecked by the Eldrazi, and that makes it feel way worse.
Yeah.
So two things. The one thing that shouldn't be overlooked is that the attack trigger is probably the deadliest part of this entire card, because it's a traumatized effect. And we know that there's a lot of cards that double, like if you mill, you double mill, right? Like there's like a curse that does that. There's Bruvok. So if you have any of those other cards, you just basically attack a player and they will mill their entire library. They'll deck out, they'll die. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it always targets one person, I think, is what like the community was very scared of.
Yeah.
Because it like sucks. It sucks to be the one who's being targeted by it. But then I just want you to know that when people, again, this is the monkey paw curling, because what do we have now instead of Lord Xander? We got Kefka, right? Because Lord Xander's just Kefka now. I only got to take half the cards from one person's hand. I don't even draw any cards from it. Oh, this card is trash. Well, what if we lowered the mana value on it, and instead of the feel bads of targeting one person, we make everybody discard? And then you draw like 3 to 4 cards, and you do it on attack and blink, on ETB and attack, and we're only making one person sacrifice some permanents. What if it flips into some nonsense thing and make everybody sacrifice, and then also have like some other stuff on. I don't even know what the back is. Who cares? It's just like insane, stupid value. Dumb. Don't like Kefka.
It is a good point that a lot of these cards seem to have been kind of power crept since they were printed, where like the ones that weren't good enough, Wizards has printed something that's like kind of similar but even better to a
we should have complained.
Crazy 3 years.
We should complain more about these cards. Lord Xander's too much, Watsy. Never again, please. This is it.
Speaking of too much, how about this one? I remember people are so hyped about this because planeswalkers are usually really bad in Commander. So when people saw a planeswalker that looked like it was formatted for a multiplayer format, people's heads just exploded, and they were, oh my god, this card was going to be so good. And that is Teferi, Master of Time, a 4-mana blue planeswalker with 3 loyalty. This says you can activate its abilities during any player's turn at any time you could cast an instant. And its abilities are +1, you loot. Draw a card, discard a card. -3, target creature you don't control phases out. -10, take 2 extra turns after this one. So the dream of this card is you slam it, and you're like, oh, I get to do it during everyone's turn, so I just keep ticking up and eventually take 2 extra turns, and how do you ever beat a time stretch? 2 extra turns is ridiculous, and if they attack it, I can even phase it out. And I don't think Teferi, Master of Time is horrible, and it is cute that you can do it during everyone's turn, but it didn't really solve the Planeswalker and Commander issue, did it? Like, it's still, like, not that great of a card, even with the upside specifically to work in the format. But what do you think about this one, guys?
I think it's a little scarier than we give it credit for. I think nobody plays it on Clash because the extra turns would be boring.
That is also
but
true.
Whenever I see it and they can protect it, it does suck. And the face
over
as well.
It's a good card. But it's just an arch enemy card. Like, you're just constantly having to protect the fairy. Yeah. This is like a crim card. This is just a crim
card. It's a
crim
card.
Like, most of us don't want to have that target on our back, but then Krim will be like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to be the arch enemy. I'll throw this into my Kefka deck. And it's like, yeah, and then you'll see that it's ridiculous. Like, this card is good. Oh my god. And now Watsy's gonna power creep this card.
It is good. I've played this in decks that like care about like when you draw a card, do this, like decks like that. It's really good because you just get to keep going on other people's turns and don't have to spend mana. But it rarely gets to stick around. Like, yeah, the ultimate's really scary if you have any way to get there faster. Like Proliferate Shenanigans or Doubling Season, anything like that, get there faster. It's crazy. But it rarely happens because everyone's like, take 2 extra turns. That probably means you win. So we just got to kill Teferi. So it rarely even makes it all the way around the table. But that said, if you do just care about like getting a little bit of looting on everyone's turns, like, and you have payoffs for that, it's still worth playing. It's just not busted like everyone thought it would be.
I feel like the ultimate almost does it a disservice by looking so scary, where this would be a cool planeswalker with a less scary ultimate that would actually probably sit out and like fill your graveyard, let you do some cool looting shenanigans, phase some stuff out. But because it's the take 2 extra turns ultimate, people feel like they really have to deal with it. Because if you do get to that ultimate, you probably win the game. If you like don't win the game with 2 extra turns, what are you even doing with your deck over there? So I think it would be better if the ultimate was not as frightening looking.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's funny that it's actually the card would be better if you just ignored, if you literally just took out the text, you didn't replace it with anything. would be like, oh, that's chill. But it's still so good.
Yeah.
Just being able to loot for 4 mana, just looting every single person's turn. And then if you need to, you can phase something out. Because the thing is, like, you can always hold up that phase out if you need it. And if you don't, you just loot. And like, the looting is good. being able to loot on everybody's turn four times per turn cycle.
And it's good. And the phase out like disincentivizes people from attacking the Teferi. But then when people are afraid of the two turns, it's like, well, you attack it and they have to phase you out and then I'll attack it so we can get rid of it. So people just team up to get rid of it. And yeah, the ultimate's just too good for its own good. But let's move on to our most recent card. We did a whole Clash episode around this card, and I still kind of love this card, but it does kind of blow my mind that people thought this card was actually going to be, like, legit good. Jumbo Cactar, a 7-mana 1/7 that has 10,000 needles, which means whenever it attacks, it gets plus 99/99 plus 0 until end of turn. So it's a 10,000 power attacker. The ultimate one-shot kill threat. If you actually hit someone with it, you're gonna kill them with it. And this is a card that I thought everyone just knew was like a kind of a funny meme card. And it's like, hey, but apparently people didn't, because I've had people actually like send me messages like, oh, I thought Jumbo Cactar was going to be like super busted. Why doesn't anyone play it? I was like, oh, I think something must have got crossed during spoiler season, because I was never trying to give you the impression that this was a good card. It's just like a very funny card. But why do you think people, like, is it just the one-shot kill thing is so threatening that people expect that to be good?
I think it's the plus 9,900 just on a card.
It still puts a smile on my face. It's so,
I still love the card.
So
it is good.
I think the content creators everywhere in the Magic sphere should write a thank you letter to WotC personally, because we all got so many views. Great content.
That was one of the best clashes, in my opinion. That
as soon as this card was printed, I think there was like all the top grossing videos of all time for Magic content creators across the sphere all were like Jumbo Cactar. And it's awesome. But yeah, thank you, WotC, for this card. it's not very good, but it's funny.
I mean, when it comes down to it, it's 7 mana. You need to attack with it. It needs to not be blocked. Like, there's still a lot of hoops to do. But no, it is also very unique when we just haven't seen a creature that's a guaranteed one-shot, like, I guess, Phage or something. But there's not many creatures that are guaranteed one-shot kills. So it's a very exciting text box and just a super funny card. But let's move on to an old card that I actually forgot about. Was this card actually hyped? I was trying to remember. This is one that actually, I think my Twitter was like, oh, this card, people are so high on. Myth Unbound, a 3-mana green enchantment that says your commander costs one less to cast for each time it's been cast from the command zone this game. So essentially, your command tax is cut in half. And then, when your commander is put into the command zone from anywhere, you get to draw a card. So essentially, a reward for playing your commander again and again by reducing the cost of it, drawing you cards. We often talk about mana advantage, card advantage being the best things in commander. In its own weird way, this is mana advantage and card advantage for playing your commander. Why did this card never take off? Is it just too narrow? Like, what is the problem with Myth Unbound?
Like, I think the idea was like, that if you have partners, then this gets kind of
even
decent.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have partners, if you have like a background commander, then it's. But yeah, I have never seen this card actually played before.
I've never seen this card before in my life.
I don't even remember if it was hyped. I don't know.
But I still can't imagine reading this and thinking, this is even good. I'm sorry, but
well, I mean, according to our stats episodes at the end of every season, like commanders come down once, maybe twice. So how much work is this really even put in into you? You could just put a different card in here for a ramp slot or a different card in here for your card draw slot, like something that's going to be more consistent.
I'm thinking about, like, I'm scratching my brain on what tech could be good. Like, I was going to say Derevi, but like Derevi doesn't need this anyway. So it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, I imagine, I'm looking back at the spoiler thread, and it seems like people are like, oh, food chain loops. If you play this in food chain, you keep casting Prosh, and you're going to, like, draw the cards, and, like, I don't know, stuff like that. But, yeah, I don't know. If you know why people are hyped about this, let us know in the comments, because I'm not exactly sure. So let's move on to the most iconic word, I would say, in Magic. We got two Lotuses coming up. The first, Timeless Lotus, a 5-mana legendary artifact that enters the battlefield tapped and then taps for Wooburg. So 5 mana, one of each color. And commander players love their mana rocks. They absolutely love their mana rocks. And this looks like a really powerful one, right? It jumps you from 5 mana up to 10 mana. I've never actually played this card, though, and if you look on EDH Rec and look at the stats, even the decks where you think it would be good, like the five-color decks, most don't actually play it, so it just kind of ended up not really doing much. What's the matter with Timeless Lotus? Is it that it enters tapped? Is it too expensive? What went wrong?
Everything. Hmm. The people they use, like, Watsy just knows that, like, the easiest way to drum a pipe is you print a card at Mythic, yeah, you put the word Lotus in it, and then it makes some amount of mana, and then people will go wild. Because I don't know, it's like, it's obvious, like, it's good casual fodder, right? Like, if you're not, like, super deep and sweaty like we are in Magic, you probably know of Lotuses. You know Black Lotus is a very powerful iconic card. What's the easiest way to, like, capture the attention of more casual players is throw in the word Lotus, make it Mythic, and have it sell your boosties. Like, that's...
It is.
So, yeah, I think this card is, like, fine. Like, yeah. I would put it in, like, a Jota deck or something, and there's some combos you could do with it. Like, there's...
Yeah, if you can, like, untap combos.
Yeah, there's, like, Filigree Sages, pay 3 mana, untap target artifact.
Infinite mana shenanigans.
They go infinite mana.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, it's a 5 mana mana rock. It's like, it's
I mean, there's 5 mana rocks that are very good. Like, Throne of Eldraine is crazy, but it is untapped. And, yeah, that's probably the biggest problem. I still play this in, it is Brawl, but in a Jota deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, if you untap with it, it is very, very good. But 5 mana, hope to untap with it, is not a winning recipe. Nah.
It's hard to take the turn off for it, right? Because if you just tap out on turn 5, you're not getting any value out of it. And you're setting up the delayed gratification for, like, a great turn in the future. But that doesn't matter if your opponent just blows it up or if you just end up dying or getting too far behind on board. So it's just hard to find time to take off to play a big tap mana rock like that. But it still makes a lot of mana.
And the fact that it taps for specifically Wooburg, I think not only does that obviously limit to how many decks can run it, but it also limits to what you would actually use it for, because not a lot of decks, like the Jota situation where your decks, where the cards literally cost Wooburg if Jota's out, but like you usually have like a card that costs like black something. Yeah. You have a card that costs like white something, you know? So the fact that it only taps for Wooburg kind of sucks.
And because it taps for Wooburg, that also means you're going to be in green by default. So do you even need a mana rock in all your green decks? Because you might just be doing land wrap shenanigans. So you automatically going to have access to Open the Ways and Rampant Gross and all that stuff. So some five color decks don't even want it just because they don't even want the mana rock. Well, let's move on to another Lotus. This one, I still think this card is insanely busted. And I know no one's doing busted things with it, but I will stand by thinking this card's insane. And that is Radiant Lotus, which is a 6 mana artifact that lets you sack one or more artifacts, and you choose a color, and target player adds 3 mana of the chosen color for each artifact sacked that way. So essentially, each artifact you sack turns into a Black Lotus, and I still think this has to be a ridiculous, like, synergy combo piece, win the game, make a bunch of artifacts, sack them, combo off. But no one does it. No one does it. No one plays with it. And I guess that includes me on Commander Clash. I've played some Brawl decks with it where it's been really good. But I haven't popped off, I don't think, at all with this on Commander Clash. It is a new card, though. It only came out, you know, this winter. It's been less than a year. So maybe there's still time. What do you guys think about this one? Because I thought this card was, like, arguably too good and just going to be absolutely busted. And it hasn't done anything yet.
I still don't Lotus. Like it. 6 mana. So, like, I play Lotus and Mishra, and it would be good in both, but 6 mana for mana.
But it's, think of, like, it's, think
immediately
of,
it's,
you play
it's
Mana
torture,
Geyser,
right?
You play Mana Geyser, think of Mana Geyser.
I mean, I don't, but you can just play Mana Geyser if you want a lot of mana.
I think this is a totally fine card, but it's just, like, very specific. Like, I would probably try it out in Lotus. I would try it out in, like, a Sam deck. Like, if I have, like, 15, I don't know, freaking tokens just sitting around and I'm pooping them out so consistently, then I could be that you could just pay 6 mana, tap it, make like, I don't know, 15 mana or something like that immediately by sacrificing 5 food. Seems
that was still
okay.
Mana burn. It is target player, so if mana burn was still a thing, I would play it in Lotus as
your,
a win
your
condition.
Luck, clues,
oh, maybe I need to put it in
deck.
There, yeah.
I don't know. It just takes a lot, you know? It's a very, very specific, and you need to have the right board to save for it, or else it does nothing. But, like, it's fine.
And,
I don't know.
And it might also be that it's just, like, too combo-y for people. I don't know, like, Karaklan Ironworks, anytime I play that in Artifact deck, I feel like I just win the game the turn I play it. But if you look on, like, EDH Rec, it's in, like, 1% of decks. Even Artifact decks, a lot of people don't play it. I don't know if it's too loopy or too combo-y or too unfair or whatever, but I think that card's absolutely, like, one of the most broken cards you can play in an Artifact deck, and people don't really play it. So maybe it's kind of the same story with Radiant Lotus, is even though it's powerful, it's just, like, not doing what a lot of people want to be doing in a game of Commander, which is like playing their big Timmy creatures and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got a couple more left. This is, I guess, a whole group of cards, one of my favorite groups of cards, which is the Mythic MDFCs from Zendikar Rising. So think of Seagate Restoration, for example. 7 mana, draw cards equal the number of cards in your hand, plus 1, and you get no max hand size. The backside is an untapped land if you pay 3 life, or it's a tap land if you don't pay 3 life. The red one, what, deals damage. The white one makes a couple of angels. The black one reanimates. The green one, probably the worst, puts a creature into play from the top 7, I want to say, for 7 mana, something like that. I love these cards. I feel like these are some of the best things Wizards has done in the game recently as a way to, like, minimize mana issues and still let you have exciting cards to play in your deck, which is always one of the biggest complaints about Magic, is I lost a game because I just couldn't do anything because I didn't draw lands. And these are, like, the best solution to that problem. I've never thought they were too good, though. I've always thought these were, like, very healthy cards. But what do you guys think about the MDFCs, the mythic ones?
I thought they were too good.
Did you think they were too good?
I still play the blue one everywhere. But I remember, was I already on Clash when they came out? This one was where I said, no, this is just an auto-include in every deck now, and they're mythics. And I play the black one and the blue one, and that's it. And now we got the same effect at Uncommon, and it's just fine.
I'm also a hater, actually. I think, I don't know, like, I don't like when cards are so generically good that they can slot into every single deck that can house them.
Yeah.
And I don't think these are quite there. I don't think they're quite there because, like, yes, I think I was higher on these cards when they were previewed, and now I barely run any of them. But, like, Modern Horizons 3 Gen came, and I don't know. I want to ask the table. How many of you run Witch Enchanter in your white decks? How many decks do you have that don't have Witch Enchanter in it, rather? Sorry.
I don't think I played in any colors, really.
I don't put it in any.
I'm a big believer in Witch Enchanter. That's in, like, every one of my decks. If I got white mana, I'm going to play it. Yeah, 5 color, I'll even play Witch Enchanter.
I was just thinking, like, 1, 2, 3, but yeah. I played them in every single one. Every single white deck that is 3 colors or less.
Yeah.
It's in every single one. I don't think that's good. I don't know. Like,
yeah, I get the idea that it's
like, it's exciting because, like, I don't want to be lane flooded or something like that. And I have something to do with my mana. But then it's like, okay, now just every single, like, my 99 is like, okay, I have Sol Ring, I have Arcane Signet, I have Witch Enchanter, I have Pinnacle Monk, I have blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, okay, well, now there's, like, less interesting things to do with my slots.
I will say that the Modern Horizons 3 ones have definitely changed it some, but these ones, the Zendikar ones, I think the blue one is the only one that is, like, borderline auto-include, and the rest are a lot more specific. Like, I just put the green one in a deck for the first time recently, and it's definitely cuttable. Like, it definitely doesn't need to be in there. It's just for flavor. Mm-hmm. It's my look at the top card of my deck, all right? It says look at the top, all right? I think a lot of the complaint with these when they were new, from what I remember, was that people thought it was, like, an offense against the mechanics and legacy of Magic itself, because in a lot of newer TCGs, they've kind of quote, fixed the mana screw issue, and you have, like, some kind of other way of using your resources so that you never actually completely get mana screwed. And this was a way that, like, you could have these MDFCs in your deck, and that kind of solves that problem a little bit. But I don't really carry that elitist view. I think that, yeah, having to use lands in your deck as a resource is part of the quirk and fun of Magic and part of what makes it different. And it creates a lot of new deck building opportunities. But, like, people trying to, like, Wizards trying to smooth it out by making MDFCs, I don't think is, like, offensive or problematic or anything.
I view it as, like, a is a reasonable compromise to make. Because I know that new players especially really, really get upset about the lands and getting mana screwed and how many do I play and I lost a game because I couldn't even do anything. So I view stuff like MDFC as like, yes, I don't like auto-includes, and I can see Seagate Restoration in specific. For me, actually, being an auto-include, I play that card in a lot of decks. So maybe that one's kind of across the line. Or like Balaghed Recovery, it's not a mythic, but that's another one I play in a lot of my different decks. So maybe some of them were pushing like a little bit too close to the auto-include line. But I really think it's, like, for me, a nice compromise for solving some of, like, the new players' dislike of mana screw issues in a way that still feels very Magic to me. Like, we've had double face cards, double face cards on a land, like, kind of makes sense. So I kind of like the way that way. I have this fear in the back of my head that eventually Wizards is just going to, like, try to get rid of lands or do something crazy like that, which I think would, like, kill the game. So I would much rather deal with, like, some MDFCs now and then than Wizards just, like, change the rules to try to make the game more like Hearthstone or something. So anyway, we got one more card, and this is the oldest card on our list. And this one came from Krim. Krim couldn't be here today because he's sick, but he was like, you guys got to talk about this card. And that card is Serra Ascendant. Serra Ascendant, a 1-mana 1/1 with lifelink, except if you have 30 more life, it is a it gets +5/+5 and has flying. So it's a 6/6 flying lifelinker for one. In Commander, basically. If you play it on turn one, you're going to have more than 30 life. And I feel like this is, like, one of the classic cards that people used to really, really hate. I haven't heard as much complaints about it recently. And I wonder if this was a product of, like, Commander being less powerful back in the day and less power crept back in the day. I still think this card is pretty good today, especially if you're in some sort of life gain deck. It's still just like, it's got a lot of stats and it gains a lot of life, especially if you draw it early. But I don't know if I really consider it problematic anymore, which sounds wild to say as a 1-mana 6/6 lifelinking flyer. But what do you guys think about this one? Is this just a product of, like, old school Magic where, you know, when Commander first started, this was so far above the curve and it's kind of evened out? Or is it still an issue today?
I think it was just funny because I thought this card was still good and y'all gave me flack for saying that I think this card is still, like, very strong. And it's like, yeah, it's so, like, we've seen, like, Krim just, like, dominated us.
Yeah.
It was just, like, a Serra Ascendant on turn one or whatever. I've seen it still show up quite often. It's always been very impressive to me. But, yeah, like, would you put this out? Like, if you're not in a life gain deck, would you run this?
I think that's where it used to be. Like, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I think there was an argument that was just like, oh, this is so far above the curve, I could run this in just, like, any deck. But now I definitely see it as a life gain card, where I wouldn't run it outside of life gain. In life gain, I think it's fine, even though it's just, like, a big creature. But the lifelink also makes it a synergy piece, right? Because you care about gaining life, and this is gaining you life. So it's not really just a big creature in a life gain deck.
And if you draw it late in a life gain deck, you probably still can have it as a 6/6, you know?
Yeah.
I get it, though. It is oppressively strong on turn one, and it is clearly not designed for Commander and kind of abuses. Like, they recently printed another card, I think in Assassin's Creed, that has this 30 life thing, but this one is way chill on the design.
It costs like 5 mana, and you have to enchant it.
Yeah, because they knew how that you have it by default. So I get it with Serra Ascendant. I don't want to ban it, but if you play it in a non-life gain deck, people just say, yeah, you're kind of just abusing an old wording here that is kind of boring to lose to this. So I think it's more like in life gain decks, you can say, oh, it's synergy and stuff. If you just run this out like a Raghavan just for value in turn one, I would say, yeah, just,
I'm out of here.
That's kind of boring.
I'm not
out of here, but it's insanely strong.
It is true. It can be frustrating. It is a frustrating card. When someone just plops it down on turn one, it is like, oh, seriously, we got to deal with this game.
Yep.
Especially in the Richard meta where we all cut swords to Plowshares. This is like the nightmare. Richard's got his Andu inversion and his farewell. I'm like, dude, we're going to be dead before I even get to cast those.
Wait, seven turns. I got an answer. Andu inversion in 7 turns, you guys.
Yeah. Decree of pain, guys.
I will say, though, it is just a big beater, but like you have 3 opponents, they have 40 life, so like surely someone's gonna live long enough to find an answer to it. I think it's okay if decks have a couple of like big beaters. It is like really scary and it is big, but like weren't people calling for this to be banned? Like in hindsight, that just seems crazy.
I could actually see, I think I've said before a long time ago that I could see making it work the way it was intended to work in Commander, yeah, where you have to get up to 50 life or something, where it's like,
because
that's how they phrase
starting.
It now, right? With most cards, is like 10 life over your starting life total. So I could see that would actually make it play as it was originally intended. Although I don't run into it enough to actually care either way, I guess. Every once in a while, someone plays it in a life gain deck and I get wrecked by it, and then I don't see it again for 6 months. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
So this is also, so I've seen it quite often because like there's life gain decks in my meta. And so in the Clash meta, we say like, surely someone could just deal with it. But we see like Crim just like destroy us like in a fairly recent game because like nobody, I think legitimately nobody had an answer
to it. No one had an answer.
But then in my like other metas where people actually do run like, you know, five spot removal for creatures in their decks or whatever each. What will happen, and I've been guilty of this myself, is like somebody puts down a Serra Ascendant, and then the person has like, I have a removal spell for it. If you don't hit me though, I'm not gonna
yeah, you're not bothering me.
And then it's like, well,
that's
then
politics,
I get to keep
baby.
And then I get to keep my spot removal, and you get to punch people in the face and make oodles and oodles of life gain. So that can also happen too. So it's not just run more removal. Like people do barter with it.
Yeah.
Myself included.
Yeah,
I think the card is very good.
Anyway, those are the cards that we had that people wanted banned during spoiler season. I'm sure there's more that you could add to the list. If you got any good ones, let us know in the comments. And we'll be back next week to talk some more Commander. So until then, everyone, have an amazing week. And this is the crew signing out.